You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Martin Page.
Hi, Mike.
And over here on my left, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike.
Cue the crickets. Let's see. Scott, Bobby, and Andrew are not with us today.
That is true.
And they're probably all together somewhere else.
I don't think so, because I took Andrew and his family to the airport this morning.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Okay.
He's actually doing, they're actually working. They're all working.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Good for them.
But I know Andrew's doing a couple gigs with the Chili Peppers, a couple broadcast gigs.
Yeah, he's going to be all over the place.
And I know Scott's been working on the movie, mm-hmm. his latest movie. And then I know Bobby's probably drinking somewhere.
Yeah, he probably is. That's the truth. Yeah.
And cracking jokes.
He's talking about us.
Actually, Bobby's been very good for a while, though, hasn't he?
He's
been with us quite consistently.
Has been, so yeah. I'm proud of Bobby.
Yeah.
We miss him.
He's making an effort, that's for sure.
Yeah. And he'll be back.
And he will be back. He said he'll be back next time, so I'm looking forward
to
that.
That means we're going to have a clean show tonight.
Maybe. Maybe.
So it'll be kind of fun. And today our guest is Jörg Koren. He is with us, and he is part of the band Blend. Mm-hmm. Jörg, welcome to the Audio Nowcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
We had Urban last time, and we're having Jörg this time. We'll get plenty of Blend.
The whole band. Yeah.
But actually, Jörg is a... well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do right now?
Well, I am... I guess we will get to that later on, but I'm from Germany, and I came here in 95. And I'm currently playing in a few bands, a few projects, a lot of recording and producing. One of the bands is Blend, obviously, which, we've been together for like over 10 years now. It's a long time. And we're working on our next single right now, which should be done, hopefully, by the end of this weekend. It has to be, actually. And I also play in a band called Orbit Monkey, which is my new project, and a band called 98 Pound Weakling.
Oh, that's cool.
Boy, you're a busy man.
Yeah, it's crazy. But it's all great stuff and a lot of fun. And aside from that, I'm working as a teacher at Musicians Institute.
Wow. So you know he has the chops.
Yes. Exactly.
But I'm crap.
Insider's joke.
Yes, it's inside joke.
You will find out what that means.
That's right. We weren't recording that.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
It'd be really, really lonely here with just the three of us.
Yes.
I wanted to start off with a few things. This is going to sound like a little bit of a downer, and I don't mean to start off on such a low note, but it's going to lead us into what I want to talk about is my grandmother recently passed away. She was 92. We had a really great service, and there was just a lot of music, and it was just really great to have the whole family together. Well, anyhow, I flew back east for that, and on the way back, I was flying, and I had my iPod on, and I was listening to music, and I got this moment where it just seemed like everything was just perfect. It was like the perfect time, the perfect song. It was the perfect, just the whole atmosphere, and everything was just really, really, it just all lined up. It was almost emotional. And it was just amazing how music can affect you, how audio can affect you in that way. And it just got me thinking, and I was thinking about that as I was driving up to do the podcast, and I just wanted to know, do you guys ever have those moments where it's just, where the music has just cuts you, just speaks so deep to you, you know, and it really doesn't matter what the song was per se. It's just the fact that here's something is that you have no direct connection. It's not, you know, other than the sound waves nothing physically is touching you, but yet it's affecting you so deep and so emotional. I mean, I was just wondering if you guys ever had that kind of an experience.
I think everybody in the world probably has had that experience at one point, because that's part of what makes music so unique, is the way people relate to it and the way a song or a piece of music in your mind will attach to a certain place or a certain point in time or a certain memory. And those attachments stay with you for life. And I've actually thought about this a lot. And what I think I've figured out is that that's the reason that each generation thinks the music of their generation is the best and the next generation must be crap.
Well, that's true.
Because any song that any generation hears, even going back to when it was classical, they attach that to their – they remember it as being attached to their childhood or to some happy memories or whatever. And when the next generation comes along and tries something new, you know, it seems like such a departure. And the earlier generation can't figure out why the younger generation is attaching to it. And that just keeps playing out generation after generation. Because music really does bind itself to the human brain somehow, if you were going to get scientific about it. There's got to be it's something more than just an amorphous idea. There has to be some real science behind it, because everybody on Earth can relate to a beat or to a sound of some sort.
It's amazing how – it's so true, because it's just amazing how deep music can touch people. And I forget about that. I mean, I'm around so much good music. I'm around so much good production that I forget about just on an emotional, you know, just on a pure, just listening level, what music can do.
I think it's as strong as a sense. I mean, they say the strongest human sense – for memory is smell. Right. You know, a smell can trigger a memory from your childhood very easily.
Hmm.
And I think that music, though there is no sense of music, I think it affects people the same as smell or sight or any other sense would.
What about you, Martin?
I think everything Rob said there is, you know, dead on. You know, it's an emotional thing. Music is, you know, it's an intangible force. It's magical. So I think, you know, as human beings, we're emotional and we have feelings. And music is a feeling. You know, it's as Rob says, I think that we, you know, if you think about it, from the beginning of time, people were moved by rhythm and they were moved by chants and dancing. And sounds, and I think it's an expression which is tremendously emotional. I do believe there's a scientific feel to it, but I think overall, music, especially today when there's so much noise going on, it's a way of us getting in touch with our feelings. I think it brings us back from the noise and from everything that's going on and makes us stop. In lots of situations, whether it's an up tune, a dance tune, a rock song, whether it's The Who or whether it's a classical piece, it makes us stop, and it makes us, in a way, reflect. Even if it makes us happy, it makes us reflect a feeling. And I think that's where the magic of music is. And I think we've all, every human being on this earth is, you know, born to feel these waves, to hear these harmonies, to hear these rhythms. It's in us right from the beginning of time.
I remember when Steve was here, he was talking a little bit about, but we're touching on right now, about how music is, you know, in some of the, you know, different cultures is a way of life. It's just part of their routine. Now, I wanted to ask you, Martin, from a songwriter's point of view, do you know when you're writing a song that, do you know certain songs like, man, this one's really gonna cut deep, or this one is gonna be good, but this one's really gonna cut deep? Because I will say, a song of yours that really, the first time I heard it, and actually, it's one thing to listen to a song, but then when you really, like, when you play it over, and then you play it over and over again, you really get that emotional part, and that was, you know, your song, The Door. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, it's a great song.
Thank you, it's just
really emotional, and I remember, when we were in Germany and that whole tour and listening to it. And I just, do you know when you're writing a song, do you get in that mode and you just know that, yeah, that's going to be it? And would you recommend for songwriters or people who want to write songs, you know, to kind of dance along, you know, that really honest place, I guess it is?
Well, that's a really good question, because, you know, if you really think about it, when you start writing songs, when you first love music, you're learning. So it's not as though you know, because you don't know how to edit yourself, whether you've got an instinct that you want to do it and that you love it. But your better songs and your better work would probably come later on after you've had experience. So now, more than anything, I know when I've hit on something, but that's because of experience. In the early years, you know, maybe for the first 5 years of writing, you're just happy that you're getting a result. At a certain point, you start to understand what is good, what is bad, what moves you, how to edit yourself, how to throw things away. And that's the big thing about what to let go of. I would say, in the last 10 years, I know what to throw away. And I think that's to do with experience. I know when something, as you've just pointed out, Mike, moves you inside your chest. You don't know why you feel something, but that the melody over that chord sequence just triggers a feeling inside you that I think makes you aware of all the things you've loved by other writers or things you've heard. And you go, this reminds me or triggers a feeling in me that I'm on the right course. Because, you know, there are such things as bad and good, and quality and not quality, or emotional and not emotional. But I truly have had those feelings when, in fact, writing these dreams, for Heart, which wasn't written for Heart, but when I was writing that song with Bernie Taupin, I knew instantly when I was writing this, and it took literally 15 minutes to write, I knew instantly that I'd hit something very quickly that was powerful. But that maybe was going to come after writing 20 songs before that,
right,
that were building to that. I've had those feelings, but I'd have to say, for all writers, that it takes a certain amount of time before you know, through experience, that what you're doing is good or bad. That's the trigger.
I think also you've probably seen this too, Martin, that when you're starting out as a writer, you tend to work on a small section of a song and you sort of fall in love with it and you do it over and over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
And anything that seems familiar, the natural human emotion is to kind of like that because it's right. familiar. It's one of the reasons it's so hard to break a song on the radio, because they only want to play things that seem familiar,
right,
which are existing hits. But when you're writing a song, you tend to go over it and over it and over it. And a lot of times you will falsely start to believe that it's good when in fact you're just getting used to it. Mm-hmm. And it's very important to step away from something when you're writing it to be able to have some kind of perspective.
Right.
I mean, as you get more experience, you don't need to bounce it off other people as much to know whether it's good or not. But it's a definite common mistake to, just because you've played a song over and over, to start to believe that it's good just because you've heard it so much. There's a difference between somebody playing your stuff on the radio over and over and you just playing it yourself over and over.
Let me ask you, as a composer who writes a lot of times purely for emotional purposes, because you know, some of the soundtracks are to add.
Oh yeah, if you're underscoring, sure.
Do you, when you're writing, do you get that same sense of like, yes, this is, I'm going to nail it on this one? I mean, this conveys all the emotion or things like that. Or
you know what? When I'm scoring music that's going to go with picture, I sort of step away from the fact that I'm the composer and I run the picture, and I just kind of listen in my head to what kind of music I would expect to be coming out of the speakers. If I was just sitting in a theater and someone else had written the music, I try to imagine what would be the right sound to go with this picture. And I step away from it as the composer, and I just try to listen to see what the picture suggests. Once I then have an idea in my mind, and I'll usually then do a MIDI sequence of it, I know right away whether it's the right emotion based on what the picture seems like to me and what the client has asked for. Because sometimes the client asks for something that is completely different than what the picture suggests. But in the beginning, it was – actually, I won't say it was that hard to do, because there are always many, many wrong answers, and it's usually pretty easy to tell when you have one of the wrong answers.
Right.
There are often a bunch of right answers, too, and the truly right answer is whichever one pleases the client.
Sure.
You know, there are different valid styles for any particular senior scoring.
This is a very good point. What I think what Rob is saying as well is, you as a writer, you have to have a belief in yourself that you trust something. You go,
sure,
like, I know this move to me feels right. This chord sequence, where I'm going feels right. So there is an element of trusting something inside yourself, and that's a very important
thing. Which comes
thing.
From experience.
Yeah. You know, that's a great point, because I will say that usually when I'm from being on the other end as the consumer of music, the music that can really speak to me in and create those, what I call those perfect moments. It's pretty honest music. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just, you can just tell there's something a little deeper in the music. And yeah. I don't know if from, you know, from the opposite end, if that writer is as honest as I'm trying to portray him.
Isn't the saying honesty is the most important thing in music, and once you learn to fake that, you'll have a real career?
That's actually good.
I think it's pretty much true, unfortunately.
What do you think?
I'm thinking that I'm actually, as a writer, although I'm been writing for quite a while and trying to write a lot and loving it, I'm still very insecure when I'm writing. I don't really know whether it's good or bad. I know it's a chord progression. I know the melody goes with it, but is this brilliant as much as I wanted to? So I'm trying not to think about whether it's good or bad or whether anybody else will like it or not. I'm just thinking, okay, I like this so far. Let's keep moving and let's keep working. And then really the confidence starts building once I start playing it for other people and get some good feedback. That's really the only moment where I'm like, okay, this actually seems to work. And then you keep working in that direction.
And you're lucky you get to play out a lot. So you get to try out this material on people when you think it's ready. And that's a big plus to be able to see how a crowd reacts. Mm-hmm. That's something not everybody gets. That's good.
Well, let me ask you, and we won't take up too much time with this, but for instance, you know, like The Door, I was mentioning how that's, you know, when you put that song on, it's really emotional, has a great story. The chord progressions are great. It has that some really powerful moments. Why don't you, you know, it's on iTunes, so if people, you know, are curious as to, you know, and I'm not trying to sell albums for you or anything, but it is, if you're curious to hear the song, if you haven't heard it, you can check it out on iTunes. But why don't you tell us a little bit about when you were writing it, a little bit about the backstory, so people can kind of connect the dots here, Martin, on that particular song.
Well, for that song on my album, House of Stone and Light, it was my own solo record, so I wasn't writing for anybody else. So, trying to get the balance between a few songs that you knew would please the record company and maybe a commercial single, well, that's definitely in your mind. But The Door came along as the kind of song that I thought I could experiment with and really, really be, true to myself and not worry about what the record company was going to think. In fact, with my playbacks to the record company before the record was released, I distinctly didn't play that song to them because I think they would have, you know, they're in one place and they would say this is much too artistic or whatever. But I held it there knowing that it was going to be maybe the last track on the album. I've always loved records that had songs like Family Snapshot by Peter Gabriel on his first solo record that was just and Intruder. Pieces that were written purely for the moment. They weren't commercially oriented. Maybe they were thought about. They came through the artistry of the person. Now, the Door, as most of my songs appear, came through sitting in the studio and jamming, basically just playing keyboards and singing phonetic vocals over a microphone that was set up live. And I had the song before I had the lyrics, but the song had a mood to it. And I always just have phonetic vocals, sounds, more just like we were talking about early on,
right,
that it's more about not what I'm saying, but the sound of the track, what the melody is. And then I didn't know what this song was, except I kept on singing All of God's Children Wait at the Door, and I didn't know what that meant, but it just came out. Luckily, walking into my office one day, and I have a lot of books in the office, one of the books was stuck out, and I thought, that's ugly, it should be pushed back in with the rest of the books. And as I pushed the book, I realized that it had an interesting title called Treblinka. And I started to look at this book and thought, when did I buy this? And it was about the concentration camp in Germany in Treblinka during the Second World War when the 600 Jews actually rebelled and escaped. And it was the first time that really there'd been a concentration camp where there had been an escape. And the Jews had decided to say, you know, we're going to make a go for it. We're gonna make a break. And it was such an amazing story that suddenly at that moment, and I had waited for this song to speak to me, that The Door became a message for either going through the door of the gas chamber or the door out into the forest and escaping. And a good example is that song phonetically we had 3 months of me just listening to the sounds and just thinking, I don't know what this is about. And then suddenly it was born. Thankfully, as I've mentioned before, I had time. And I think time is a great, if you get that time, sometimes you can do something exceptional and you let it speak to you. And I had a bit of time on that and it appeared. I didn't force the lyrics. They came after. And, as you say, Mike, you know, we, that song over a period of years became one of the best live songs we played, which really was, you know, even I remember when the record company heard the album, they said, yeah, okay, you know, nice, that's nice finish, you know, but emotionally to the audiences and to the people over a period of time, that song has lasted longer than any others, you know.
When we played in Nuremberg.
Yeah, it was amazing.
That was amazing. It was a big MTV concert and it was raining and you've said this story before, but it was great. It's a great song.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's just,
I think that's a good example. I'm sure it's not the same for most people, but I had the luxury of a song that was recorded with just phonetic vocals, and I wasn't sure what it was about, and I didn't have to force it.
I think if you take that attitude of you kind of let the song write itself, and it's going to take however long it takes. I mean, I think most great songwriters would say that's the way they work, and same with scoring the picture. You kind of let the music, once you have experience to allow this to happen, you let the music kind of write itself.
Yes. I wouldn't have been able to do that if I was 16.
Sure.
And you know what? That's interesting that you say that, because the Godzilla trailer that you did, I'll never forget when I first heard that and I heard the beginning and it was just so light and so perfect, you know,
with the Chalice playing?
Yeah, just the really light intro, and you think it's one thing, and then all of a sudden it turns
it's
into
Godzilla.
it does take quite a turn, doesn't it?
But it's so perfect. It was just like, it was really perfect, and now I see
that was completely about letting the music speak to us, because that was the first trailer I had ever written music for, period, and it was a 100-piece symphony orchestra.
Wow.
So I basically sat at home watching a tape of it wasn't even a rough cut of the trailer. It was just pencil drawings because they hadn't shot the scenes yet. So I sat there watching these pencil drawings go by over and over and over. And I just thought to myself, if I was sitting in a theater, and I can sort of tell what the visuals are going to be, if I'm sitting in a theater, what is the soundtrack to this going to be? And I'm sure because I was new, it ended up being an amalgamation of probably lots of things I've heard in the movies. I mean, I'm sure I borrowed from all the music I've loved since I was a kid. And it turns into sort of my version of a hodgepodge of all the stuff that's moved me as I've listened to movies.
But it works. And I think
I think everybody works that way. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I agree.
All right. Well, let's get back. Do you have any recent experience where music has just really touched you deep or anything? Or?
Actually, that's funny you said that, Mike. Literally about 20 minutes before I came here, I thought this has been out for quite a while, but I kept on hearing this song. At different times, and it was by Rob Thomas. The song he just did for the a recent movie, and it was called, gracious me, it was called Little Things or Small People or whatever it was. But I thought that was a really, really beautiful song. And I was, on my MySpace page, Rob Thomas, you know, we're all friends and everything, and I went onto his site and heard the track. I was moved by that song, and I think that was great, a very, very, very touching song. And that's, you know, that's 20 minutes ago where I couldn't stop playing it and just thought that the melodies and that and the emotion is very powerful.
Ken, you were telling me you just had a moment like that when I was discussing.
Well, I was driving earlier and Billy Joel, Piano Man, came on, and it kind of sent chills up me. I hadn't heard it since I was a kid, but. Mm-hmm. Thought it was a great song.
For music to be able to like send chills, I just think that's just.
But that's again a great example for the power of music. Yeah. Well, if it reminds you of your childhood, I had an experience not too long ago when we were listening to some. I went to see the Police live, and they played "Message in a Bottle," and it reminded me of when I first heard that song, which was like, you know, a long time ago, and I had my first audio, like a hi-fi system with vinyl, actually, like a turntable. And that was the only vinyl LP that I had back then, that Police album. And I put it on, listened to Message in a Bottle, and it just killed me. It just threw me. And I just kept listening to it, like, over and over. The sound of it and how it's all, like, the textures.
Yeah.
And I cannot hear it like that anymore today because I know too much about it and do too much recording myself and all that stuff. You know how it all works. But back then, it just was electrifying.
Well, sometimes you just got to step away. I mean, sometimes you get so close to music and I just like sometimes I just have to stop and just turn off my brain and not try to listen and just into the music, but just listen to the music and just kind of let it, you know, just.
I think that's what happened to you when you were coming back on the plane. You know, you've just been through something which is very emotional.
Right.
The funeral.
No, it's probably true.
And I think you were, you know, rebooted as such.
Yeah, because I wasn't listening to, oh, how's the reverb on the snare drum?
Or that's right. You're in a different space.
Just wash over me. And it was really amazing. I don't know. That's why I think I'm so addicted to audio, because sound can just, whether it's in the movies or whether it's in music or whatever, it can touch you like nothing else can touch you.
So powerful. We've talked about this a bit before, but if you think about it, the way sound can affect you emotionally, it's way more powerful than a vision can.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. A painting isn't going to give you the same emotion. I mean, maybe a very tiny percentage of the population, but I don't think a painting is going to give people the same kind of emotion as a song. And if you think back years ago, there was radio, you know, which was audio only, but there were never truly silent movies.
Right.
There always had to be a piano player or something.
Yeah.
The picture without the sound can't sell the emotion, but the sound without the picture can sell the emotion very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mm-hmm. You know, one thing about, you know, with just when you start listening to music and you start really digging into the emotion, we're putting together, although we're not going to do it on this podcast, we're going to put together an iMix for iTunes where, you know, I've asked everybody in the panel to contribute a couple songs to, but you know, I've been putting some playlists together, you know, for a friend of mine, and it's just really great to, when you start looking at music and you start wanting to, you know, I know we've talked about this before, but you know, you want to share music and you want to share, you're sharing emotion, you're mm-hmm. sharing, it's more than just the music, it's either what you want them to think or what you want to expose about yourself to them, or you know, it's just, I mean, I don't know anything else that can do that.
Well,
you know?
It's funny when you think about the new technology as well, even with YouTube, you know, you find people are just emailing videos of tracks, not mm-hmm. even because of the video as much as saying, oh, remember this track, you know, and they're sending it to their friends like letters,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's again another sign of just it's almost like a handshake,
yeah.
and saying, you know, remember this song, this really moves me. Or if two lovers are sending, you know, two tracks to each other now very quickly, you know that it's a human communication.
Yeah, especially like when you send tracks to people, because you're like, you know, there's a little bit of mystery as to
yeah,
what
and you're
trying
feeling
to say
something, yeah.
and what, oh, what are they trying to say, and
or sometimes
kind of
people can't even say it
exactly,
but yet when they send that track or they send that YouTube video, they're trying to say, this is what I feel and I'm trying to communicate this to you. You know, I know you feel the same thing as I do, I hope this moves you, and that's a big sign, you know, it's a human communication.
It's like the modern mixtape.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, that's just it. Exactly. Yeah. It's a modern mixtape, and those mixtapes, I mean, I remember being in high school, you know, with the cassette. Okay, ready? Go. And then, you know, I don't know if you ever made mixtapes, but I made all kinds of mixtapes, and I had to have perfect edits on each one. And if I didn't get the perfect edit, I always left a couple seconds in between each song, right? Because if I didn't, if you heard that, it's
like, oh, see, you're a technician. There you go.
So some of them had like 2 seconds between songs, and some of them had like a half second.
It was obvious you were going to do a podcast when you grew up.
Yeah,
obvious.
You know what? This you would like this. Then this just came up in the last few days. My business partner Gary Olazabal,
right.
Now known as Gary Adante, long story, but he engineered and mixed songs in the Key of Life and a lot of Stevie's classic stuff from way yeah. back then. And he was telling me how they used to assemble those albums, because if you listen to Stevie's albums, not just from back then, but even now, he always rhythmically moves from song to song, or sometimes there'll be a rhythmic crossfade, like you hear the drums ending and the drums of the next song
right.
starting up. And it would always have a feel to it. The songs would flow into each other really well. And he told me what they used to do when they were finished mixing is they would actually assemble the final master tapes so that you'd have songs 1, 3, 5, 7, whatever, the odd songs on one tape on a tape machine, and then the even songs on another one. And then when it was time to master the album, they'd get all the mastering settings for each song, you know, the levels and compression and EQ and everything else. And they would have to perform that live, obviously.
Oh, man.
And then they would have to learn how to start one tape machine so that a song would kick in rhythmically exactly right, you know, to feed out of the previous song as the previous song fades out. And so each side of the album, they would have to perform live. And if you messed up on hitting the play on the last song on that album, mm-hmm. that whole master was shot. Yeah.
That's why he still can't listen to songs when he keeps listening.
No, that's why he got into disc recorders real early. But back in those days, all those classic albums, wow. the mastering had to be performed like that. So
you can tell as well, because it's got such a feel to it.
It's performed down to the last second.
Yeah.
One of my the highlights of my making mixtape career was when I was in junior college, and I had a friend who was in the radio. The radio program, and he let me into the radio booth, and I didn't have to just start and stop on one. I had two turntables. That was like, that was nice. That was nice, because then you could just crossfade. Yeah. You don't have to worry about that.
In the early days, I would actually make mixtapes off the radio, so I'd have to wait till I thought they were about to play my favorite song. Because they'd say it was coming up. That's not a real convenient way.
Well, hey, I'll tell you what. We're going to take a break now, and we've got a bunch of stuff to talk about, and I didn't mean that first segment to go so long, but actually that was kind of good, and there was some really good insight there, Martin and Rob. So we'll take a break right now, and we'll see you on the other side.
Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast, and I don't know, I'm not missing Bobby this time.
Not at all. Not at all. Actually, I think the show is just going along much better, smoother.
Yeah, I'd have to say.
I think the people here are much better looking.
On average, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No taller.
No filthy jokes every 2 minutes.
So much love around here.
Yeah. No, we miss him. Miss him.
Do you?
Not really.
Just you. We love you, Bobby. We love you.
Okay, we miss Andrew and Scott, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You mean the intelligent side of it? We're missing that.
That's right. Our IQ has kind of gone down 20 points without Andrew and Scott. Actually, when Andrew does get back, I was talking to him on the phone before he left, and he was over at the, what was it? Green Aid? What was that?
Oh, the concert in London.
Yeah.
Wow.
But what was the name of the whole thing?
That's right. He did the whole show, didn't
he? Boy, my brain is just not functioning right now. Anyhow, he was there and,
Live Earth.
Yes. So, he's gonna tell us a little bit about that as well as some of the other stuff. So,
we'll have some stories.
Yep. We'll have some stories when he gets back. We're here with Jörg Coring, and, Jörg, let's just talk a little bit about, tell us a little bit more about your story, because, I found it really interesting the fact that you came over here, and tell us a little about your music and how that brought you to the States and what you're doing now.
At the time in Germany, I was living in Hamburg, and I was working a little bit as a teacher, getting a little bit my hands onto some recording equipment in the school that I was working at, which was called Music Station, and that was sort of my first little experiences with recording a band and recording stuff in the studio. And at the same time, I was working in various musicals on the Reeperbahn, how should I call it? The red light district there. But that's where all the music's going on and where all the clubs are. And, there's like pretty much all the musicians in Hamburg are having some gigs there, working in some musicals, whether, you know, it being a live band on stage or somewhere in the pit or somewhere.
Was it like musical theater or like nightclubs?
No, theaters. Musicals like.
Well, I know it's called
what
that,
kind
but
of plays
it's,
are those? Right.
It's not the exact kind of red light district that you would think of from here.
It's very different. Like all the big musicals, Cats and Phantom of the Opera and all these musicals are going on there. And I was playing Grease and things like that.
Sorry.
It's not quite as bad.
Yeah.
Of course, after the show, then it's a story. And anyway, it was all good and a lot of fun, but somehow I felt that I was stuck in that situation, and band-wise and music-wise, there wasn't enough creativity going on for me. So I felt like I need to explore more and need to go somewhere where there's a better for lack of a better word, breeding ground for being creative and having the band thing going on. That's really what I was kind of missing.
So you were playing actually in the bands for some of those big plays that were going on there.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, there was, for example, Grease had like a little band on stage,
right,
where the music was performed live,
right,
with the play itself at the same time.
Wow. I mean, that, you know, not to get off topic, but I really, you know, every time I go see a player, you know, a musical, those guys in the pit are just, they're just top notch, and they're always covering more than just one instrument. And some of the parts that you have to, because you get such a big sound with such a small group of people, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's very demanding in the beginning, especially. It's like very stressful to get it all right and to please the musical director,
right,
which is always the big deal. But once you've done a few shows,
well,
and it
true.
Becomes a routine, and it's no big deal anymore.
That's true. I'm sure show 65. It's
yeah,
kinda
exactly.
You kind of got it down.
Yeah, you get used to it. So anyway, I was looking for something, you know, more creative, and I thought friends of mine were talking always about Los Angeles and Musicians Institute, you know, being known all over the world, being a good place to meet people and you know, check out Los Angeles, which, you know, is always sounds like the best place in the world to everybody in Germany. Which, when I came here, it's a whole different story. But anyway.
It always is.
It always is.
But, yeah, I thought I should check it out over here and came here. And I left myself a little bit of a window. I'm like, if I don't like it, I go back, big deal. But I'm going to check it out. And if I like it, I might stay. And that's exactly what happened.
So then, did you meet Rob right away? Or were you doing a few things first? Or how did the...
I met Rob a few years later, actually, through some other band, actually the band 98 Pound Weakling, that I was just becoming a member of at the time. They had some recording sessions booked with you.
Yeah, we had done some recording with them and were trying to figure out what their sound was.
Mm-hmm. And they were looking for a guitar player, and I joined them. I think actually you recommended that they should look for another guitar.
Yes. That was not a tough recommendation to come up with at the time.
Wow.
No, they'd admit it too.
Wow. So you just said, yeah, I'd love to work with you guys, but you need a better guitar player?
Actually, the founder of that band I've known for a really, really long time. And I had helped him with solo things before, and then I had just helped him for a long time as he put his band together.
I got you.
So it was more like a friendly thing. But when Jörg came in, it was... very refreshing for them to have a serious musician playing guitar, because it had really just been kind of a fun band up until then. It wasn't really that serious. It was sort of experimental and fun. And then when Jörg started playing with them, the music became more musical.
Right.
And that was a good thing. Jörg had been playing with other people in the States here before I met him.
Yeah.
So when you came to the United States, were you a student over at Musicians Institute first? Or?
Yeah. I thought that was maybe a good starting point for various reasons. One of them was the visa situation. Of course, you got a student visa, so I enrolled at MI for 1 year, and I thought also I could meet a lot of people there, you know, make connections, and I also have to admit I had to improve on my English quite a bit. So I thought that was a good, you know, starting point to ease myself into it.
And how was it when you came from Germany, coming over to the United States? Did you notice anything different as far as the musician community or how they gig over here or anything of that? I mean, what was the biggest contrast between America, the States, and Germany?
The attitude.
Really?
Absolutely. I came to the States beforehand. I went to Boston, to the Berklee College of Music, and here to the to MI to find out which school I would like better. And what I liked about MI and the West Coast was that refreshing, positive, energetic attitude that people had about music. They were just like, the teachers were always smiling and making jokes and having fun, and playing was always... People were getting together playing, no matter what style, I have to add, which is really important. You play jazz, you play rock, you play metal, you play hip-hop. It's all music. There's no one's being frowned upon or anything, which
right.
happens quite a bit in Germany.
Wow.
Yeah, there's like, you know, jazz guys think they're cooler than the classic guys think they're cooler than the pop guys, and it's just like, they don't really talk to each other.
Wow. Of course, the classical guys are cooler than everybody else.
Or so they think.
So you were a student for a year, and then from there?
Yeah, and I right away met Urban, whom you guys know now already too, and we started the band Blend back then, and started writing and working together. And after my year at MI, I started sort of slowly but surely working there as a teacher, which I'm still doing, sort of my regular income. Along the road, we did a lot of recordings with Blend and eventually had the opportunity to record our debut album at Steve Vai Studio, The Mothership, which was a great experience with still everything all on tape and analog and no Pro Tools, no nothing. Two studio machines running at the same time. It was really cool.
No Pro Tools. How do you record? I don't understand.
Those were the days. How does it work?
Okay, so if you don't have Pro Tools, what were you looking at on the monitor then?
Actually, there was
your
a monitor.
Instrument.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great. That's quite an adventure to get you where you're at right now. And I do know that you're with Urban and Blend, and you're going to be actually. That's kind of ironic. You're going to be going back to Germany for a tour.
It's so crazy. Yeah, we actually at some point did a few low budget tours that we just organized ourselves, going back to Europe and touring there. And sure enough, we got signed over there to a label in Cologne, and we're still with them, and we're still going back every once in a while to go on tour and have songs released over there.
So wait, so you're in Germany and you have to go to the United States, so you can be big in Germany again. I'm moving to Sweden.
Well, you also did touring with other groups. I think that was right before I met you, right?
Yeah, I was right after we recorded our debut album with Blend, I was doing a few auditions for other bands, and one of the bands was Lifehouse, and I started playing with them when they had their, like, the Hanging by a Moment.
Oh, yeah.
The big hit single.
Did you play on that, Hanging by a Moment?
No, that was already recorded, and then I joined as the touring guitar player for them.
Oh, okay.
So you've played the song 10,000 times just...
About.
Yeah.
How was that? I like that band, I like their new album is really good, too.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was that was a wonderful experience. That was definitely the highlight of my music career in terms of playing, you know, live and playing big places in front of a lot of people. It was amazing.
That's a great song. That's a really good song. That's a great band too. Wow, that's great. Hey, I want to ask you. I want you to put on your teacher's hat over at MI, because this is going to lead us into what we're going to talk about. I played in a band a long time ago, and we had a guitar player from MI who had the most amazing chops. I mean, he was such a good guitar player, and he knew all his scales and everything. But he wasn't that creative. You know, he just, when it was time to kind of...
Crop. A word that's going to start popping up.
We talked about this earlier, and everybody's wondering where we're going.
That's right. That's right.
In a word.
It's so good.
Full circle.
No, but I, as a teacher and being plugged into MI, do you see those students? And how would you... I mean, what kind of advice would you give to people so that they don't fall into that trap? Because I know, you know, since then I've met some other guitar players, and I've met some MI guitar players that are really great, but I've met some, you know, and it's not just MI, I should say, you know, same goes for any of those schools like Berklee or whatever, where you get just so technically good, but then you lose all your creativity, you know, and it's just not, I mean, how do you make the balance? What would you say? I mean, what kind of advice would you give to people out there who really want to study the technique, but yet are losing out on the creative side of things?
Yeah, I think that is just a natural downside of being academic about music and sort of trying to figure out how to teach something that is so emotional, as we talked earlier.
Right.
That is actually not really, you cannot really teach it, but you have to find a way to teach it in an academic situation. And even more so when you're trying to teach rock and roll, which is actually... far from being academic and being a school situation. It's sort of the rebellion against everything else. So how do you put these two things together and make it work? And that is tricky, and I think there is no solution to it. I think once you during the time when you study, you have to study,
right?
And you focus on that, and you just have to let go on your creativity a little bit. You have to mm-hmm. get your mind focused on what you need to learn, because it's so much information, so much stuff. If you don't really get into it and dig into it, you will not get far enough to then eventually let go and forget about everything,
well,
and then come back to it, to your creativity and the reasons why you started doing it.
That's a good point. You got to learn enough to get you to the place where you can let go, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like building the tools in your toolkit or the paint in your palette. You have to have all that stuff squared away before you start to be creative.
Right.
Once you've studied and learned how to play the instrument, that becomes a tool you can use. And at that point, you're supposed to forget about the hardware, you're supposed to forget about the toolkit and just worry about the song, because if your chops are there,
right,
whatever you're hearing in your head, you're going to be able to recreate with your hands, and you're not going to have to think about the tools. A painter doesn't have to think about how to hold the brush, and neither does a great drummer. Ooh, that was kind of poetic.
I like that.
Wow.
That was very emotional.
That's the quote from MySpace page.
Wow. But, you know, no one should have to think about the instrument while they're playing it. I mean, you'll never see a great pianist looking at their hands. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be able to look at the music in front of you, not at your hands while you're playing. So that carries over for every instrument. And all you have to do if you want to hear a technique without emotion is go to every booth at the NAMM show. You know,
that's true.
Where every demonstrator is being paid by the note,
right?
It seems. And you'll hear all the technique you can imagine, but is there actually music there? That's debatable.
Well, that's the thing, because it's like, you know, he was doing all the jazz, you know, chords and all the scales, and he was really burdened. But when you were just looking for maybe, you know, a good 16th note pattern just to kind of mm-hmm. give a little mm-hmm. rhythm to the thing, it just wasn't there.
Absolutely.
Give your students assignments where, you know, use three chords and that's it.
We do talk about that every once in a while, because you're absolutely right. When you walk around in school, it sounds a lot like the NAMM show or the Guitar Center or something like mm-hmm. that. Of course, that's just in the nature of learning scales and all that stuff. And the students totally do get stuck in all these things, all these possibilities that they just learned about, you know, and they're excited about it, and they're trying to get every scale and every chord.
So they have to use all of them all the time, right?
Exactly. So, of course, it will sound like crap for a little while, but eventually, and that's of course that's the big step. Eventually, you will have to let go, and not everyone can make that step. Not everyone is talented enough to make that step either. But if you're able to let go eventually, then, like you said, all the technique and the knowledge that you learned in school will right. benefit you, and then you can let it out, and it will actually help your creative process as well.
It's one of the great things, actually. I think also when you're learning and you are learning all the scales and the technical side of it and everything you need to learn in your toolbox, is sometimes to go back and listen to a record or something, somebody you like. You know, you can go back, if you like rock and roll, and listen to The Simplicity of Creedence Clearwater Revival, and you'll listen to, you know, well, that's speaking loud, but there's hardly anything going on. It's a great vocal performance, and it's just a guitar and drums, but everything's at a minimum. And I think, you know, it's, I like to say to somebody, you know, even if they're very well trained, is like, if you're having a little bit of a struggle in knowing where you take this to, but you listen to what's already been out there and produced in front of you that you respect, you know, listen to the Motown records. And listen to how technical maybe the string lines are, but really how wonderful the drums are. There's a simplistic feel to them. I think that's that's another great skill is to say, I have all the tools, but now I'm not going to use them all. What tools do I use for this job?
Right.
And half of the skill is knowing what not to do.
Yeah. Good point.
I actually had just a quick funny story. I did a session a long time ago. For a songwriter named Desmond Child, who's a really successful songwriter. And I had never met him before, and he came to the studio, and he said, who's going to be playing keyboards? And everybody said, Rob will. So he came over to me and he said, I'm sure you're a great keyboard player, and I'm sure you know all kinds of tricks. I want you to play this song like you just learned how to play yesterday. Simple. Nothing fancy. And that's the secret, or one of the secrets. I mean, he's a very talented guy, but that's one of the secrets to his stuff being so accessible song-wise, because it's not based on a bunch of fancy tricks. It's based on good, solid chord changes. And he wanted me for these demos to play good, solid chords, nothing too fancy, nothing frilly. And I guess a guy like that who works with a lot of session players is used to every player trying to blow them away, show them how they're the most impressive player on earth.
Right.
And now, as a producer myself, I don't care. I assume anybody I hire can do those kinds of parlor tricks on their instrument, because they wouldn't have gotten successful unless they could do that somewhat. But really, all I care about is what emotion they bring to a song, and that's what he was saying back then too. And it really is the much more important thing.
Well, if you ever need a keyboard player that can play the keyboards like they just learned.
No, it's like they just learned, not just because they just learned. It's a difference.
You can call me.
I think it's a really good point as well, Rob brought up. But at the same time, there's a thin line as well. You know, when you're in that situation where you also want your players to maybe feel like they can do something.
Of course, yeah.
And then you go like, wow, you know, I haven't tied them down too much yet. Somebody just played an inversion there, which just blows us away. So it's that real fragile line about.
And I think that'll come through, though. If it's a truly great player.
Sure.
Like, I've heard Greg Fillinganes play on a bunch of things, and he's an incredible keyboard player. And he knows, though, how to play the simple version of
a
song.
Yeah.
But when it's time for him to stretch out a little bit, his voicings and things, there's another level of amazing technique there that doesn't have to be overpowering. And it's a lot of times it's subtle. It's just perfect.
Yeah.
Well, it's like Jimmy Copley playing drums on your record. Jimmy's the drummer that Martin uses a lot, and he lays a really solid beat down, and you would think if you listen to it, it's like, oh, he's a solid drummer, and then all of a sudden he'll just put these little tasty little fills in, these little licks, and you're like, wow.
But it's interesting. They're hooks. You know, I was thinking that my way to the podcast, listening to drummers and how Ringo was with the Beatles, that these drums become, we think they're just rhythms, but the little fills are hooks.
Absolutely.
They're hooks. And, that's something.
I've bought songs because of a drum fill or because of one riff. I mean, those things are every bit as powerful if they're done well.
And feel, of course.
Yes.
Speaking of Ringo.
And truly great session players, really, as Rob was saying, truly great session players have the ability to do a lot of stuff, but also know how to really, you know, restrain themselves for the power of the song, you know, communication.
There does come a time, though, you know, in any session at some point, like if you're the guitar player on the session and it's solo time, the producer is going to turn to you and say, you know what? Just blow me away. Just absolutely. I want to hear 64th notes and I want you to just lose your mind and let's hear a solo. And so at that point, it is kind of cool if you can step up and deliver that stuff, because when you've done a song and your rhythm is great and you're not showing off and then it's time to step forward, you know, one of the keys to success is be able to blow them away.
Yeah, that's true. I will say, you know, one of the things, the props that I got to give to, you know, MI and schools like Berkeley is a lot of the guys that come out of there, they do have a good sense of groove, man. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because they play with a lot of some of the other people do, but I don't meet too many people who've gone to those schools and not.
I think you've been lucky.
Really?
And you were hearing it from him.
Well, that's true. Because I do, you know, the couple guitar players that I do know and the drummer that I know from Berkeley, I do know that those guys can groove, you know, so. Mm. Which, you know, I wanted to ask you, do you have students? Not that I know anybody like this. Yes, I do, but you ever have, like, do you have students that are just really arrogant, that are just, their egos are, you just can tell their egos are going to get in their way because they think they're God's gift to whatever instrument they're, you know, in your case it would be guitar. And, and how do you ever try to, like, you know, slap a reality factor on them, or do you just kind of let them be the way they are? You know, because I think ego really keeps a lot of people from creating. Because they so want to impress people with their skills and with their little scales and things like that. That
it keeps them from growing as well.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I'm just wondering, can you just spot those guys when you're teaching? And do you want to name any names?
No, absolutely. I actually have one wonderful teacher, who's actually a vocal teacher, Jamie Lula, who's also singer, songwriter, and performer. And I remember, and never will forget the words that he said to us when I started as a student. He said, you have to empty your cups. If you don't let go of all the stuff you know already, there's no space for new information to come in. So empty your cup, and then you will learn and gain, and eventually what you already knew when you came here will come together, and you will grow even more so. And I always try to remember that and sort of try to go into every class and every situation where I could learn and just be open-minded. I mean, that's even outside of school. I mean, that's just a life situation. You just have to be open to the information that could come to you instead of shutting it off by throwing stuff at people all the time.
That's absolutely true. And I think, you know, to kind of wrap this up, it seems like, you know, if you have the opportunity to take advantage of, you know, going to like an MI or going to a Berkeley or any of the other schools that are out there, you know, you want to learn the chops and you want to learn the licks, but you also want to be open to experimenting and knowing when to let go.
It is hard because in those schools, there's definitely the peer pressure of, you know, who can play the fastest. You know, when I was growing up, I used to consider it a challenge to just see how fast I could play a classical piece.
Right.
You know, completely no emotion at all, but I used to just time myself. I mean, the quality of the performance was based on how long it took. And it's not, I don't think that's uncommon as a kid because you can't measure emotion.
Yeah.
Right. You know? So you got to measure something.
It's a real balance. I mean, it's really.
It becomes one, yeah.
It's like, you know, like it is in life. I mean, there's a middle way. You know, you have to find that middle ground where you say, you know, I need to practice. I need to have that ego to get good on my instrument. I need to love the instrument. And then I need to understand, you know, restraint and what makes music really, really touch people.
Yeah. You know? It's part of growing up.
And I think on the other side, you know, I mean, I bought a couple, you know, DVD, drum DVDs, because I wanted to learn, you know, some new stuff and
didn't work, did it?
No. No, it didn't.
Sorry, Mike.
No, but I think you always need to, you know, never stop learning, you know. I mean, I wish I could go to school for drums or for keyboards. I mean, I wish that would be my, you know, full-time gig. And so I think it's never too late to always just learn a little bit more, always brush up on your technique.
Well, we were kids in England, though, I think, you know, and the same as it probably was for the guys in Germany. You know, when you think about Americans, we're teaching, letting people learn rock. They were letting them learn guitar. You know, in my era, it was like, you know, you learned it through your grandfather or something. But there was a school that was actually teaching funk bass. only in America. You know what I mean? No, it was pretty phenomenal.
That's very true.
You know what? I didn't know there were such schools. I ended up going to an engineering college. Even though music was my passion, it never even occurred to me that I could get an education in, you know, like R&B music.
You didn't go to music school?
I've never gone to music school in my entire life.
Taught yourself.
I've had home piano lessons. I mean, I started classical piano when I was 3.
Wow.
I'm completely self-taught, though,
That's great.
That's great. That gives a lot of people hope out there who's never been
there. And I learned everything from records. Just playing
If you love
records,
it, you figure out a way to learn it.
Yeah.
Because Rob, you're a...
Did you hear what Rob said? That's a huge thing. Yeah. You know, if you love it, you learn it however you can, you know. It goes right back to folk guitar, you know, and the blues guitarists down south. They played it very unusual. You know, they could string, if they played left-handed, they got hold of a right-hand guitar and strung it differently. Mm. If you're gonna do it, you're gonna do it. I learned everything off of records, you know, just having headphones on and making mistakes until you got it.
Well, I've told friends of mine, like orchestrators I've worked with and different people, I've said, you know, I kind of regret I didn't know this was going to be my career because I could have gone to school for this and actually learned the right way to do some of the things that I had to figure out myself. And what people have told me, because they've been through it the other way, they've been through the schools, you know, a lot of classical orchestrators have been through, you know, a huge amount of training. And what they've said is that if I were to go through that training even now, it would probably change the way I do things, but not necessarily in a positive way. Mm-hmm. Because if I figured out my own path through it and I'm getting the work done, you know, the rules are only the rules unless you come up with better rules. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about getting the final product done.
But I think in your case, I mean, I'm just, you know, I guess I'm going to toot your horn right now, but I've seen the way you've worked, especially like doing your demos and stuff like that. I mean, you can just like, you pop out those bass, you know, riffs. Okay, I'm going to demo this. And meanwhile, he's writing this great song, mm-hmm. you know, and just doing this little demo. And I think it's only because you're so open and you've kind of found your own way to create music that it just kind of comes out like that. Cause some of you, you know, you got to record some of those NAMM Show demos you've done. There's some cool grooves in there.
No. I'm glad you like them, but no.
All right. Well, hey, we gotta start wrapping this up. But Jörg, thank you so much for hanging out with us today.
All right,
Jörg.
Thank you very much.
That's great. And then we want to thank Ken for being there. Our engineer.
Yeah.
No problem.
And Ken, next time we're gonna have to talk because you just went and did some acoustic treatment to your little home studio. So you're gonna have to give us a rundown next time.
You bet.
And Rob. Are you up mm-hmm. to anything fun and exciting that you can talk about?
Well, actually, in the next few weeks, I'm going to be able to talk about a whole bunch of stuff that's almost ready to talk about, but not quite yet. But I will say this. Next Wednesday, theoretically, the first three pieces of the furniture that I ordered in March are supposed to show up. I've been to the factory and seen them. I've seen the glass that's going to go on top of them. I've seen the stain sample of how they're going to be stained. I have been sworn to that the stuff is going to be delivered the middle of next week, and I'm really excited, and I've already had all the rewiring done. I had to do a huge amount of rewiring to accommodate the new furniture, right. Which, by the way, is something people should think of when you change your furniture.
Right.
Change your wiring. Don't try to get a Frankensteinish kind of setup where you try to make the old cabling work in a way that it's not
right.
meant to.
Right.
The proper wiring is important. So the wiring is done. The first three main pieces of furniture are supposed to come next week, and that is truly going to change the way I work. It's going to change the whole flow.
Oh, that's great.
And then more things coming soon.
Yes, because there's a lot of stuff that's pending on your furniture.
There sure is. I haven't. Yeah, there. Actually, you know what? You say it jokingly, but there are a lot of meetings that I need to have with some high-end people who can't see my studio set up on milk crates the way it is right now.
No. Well, you know, as I just want to let the listeners out there know that we're going to be starting a video segment for the Audio Nowcast called Spaces, and the first space we're going to go into is going to be your studio, and we're just waiting. and you're going to be touring in Germany.
Yeah, exactly. September. We will go on tour again with Blend in September in Germany for, I'm not exactly sure, a couple of shows. We will probably play the Popcom, which would be very exciting. And I have a few shows coming up with my project, Orbit Monkey, and hopefully my album will be done soon as well.
Busy man.
And Blend's on it's CD Baby, correct? And people can look Blend up on CD Baby,
and also MySpace.
And MySpace, mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
And I think we have a link from when Urban was on the last show to CD Baby, but I'll put the same link on your name too.
So, awesome, great.
We'll have two opportunities.
Thank you.
And Martin, we're getting close. I know.
Yeah,
that.
We are close. September's the release of the album, and I delivered the masters to the plant on last Monday, which was exciting. And my new official website is being built, and it's just around the corner. And you're helping me, Mike, with some final editing on the EPK. So everything is very near, just like Rob's furniture.
So. I think we've been hearing about these things since the beginning of the podcast.
Wow. You know, when both these things happen, we're not going to have anything else to talk about. Well, I do want to plug a couple things really quick. Coinciding with Martin's release, we're going to be doing another live podcast.
Because
the first one. And the live podcast that we're going to be doing is actually going to be open. So we're going to, you know, if you're out there and you want to come check us out, we're going to be giving you some more details on that. And you can come out and we're going to do a podcast and we're going to probably listen to Martin's album. We're just going to have a great time. So,
Perfect.
So if you're interested in that, drop us an email and you can get us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can join us and we're going to have a great time and it should be fun. So, we'll give you all the details. We're still working on the studio and where that's going to take place, but it'll be good. So it'll be kind of fun. And actually, that's our first live podcast is where I met.
That's right. Yeah.
Is where I met Jörg. So, so you don't know. You may go from a live podcast to being on the panel.
Could happen.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to everybody being back next time.
I'm not. I think we had a lot more space to travel, right. Didn't you? I mean, you know what I mean? We could focus, couldn't we, Rob? We could focus.
Absolutely. We didn't have to talk about movies.
Yeah, we could dominate. I mean, for goodness sake. Domination.
So you know what we'll do?
Yeah.
We'll just tell them, you know, to show up on Tuesday, but we'll actually do
exactly.
it on like Wednesday.
Oh, there you go.
I don't mind cardboard replicas of the boys sat around the table.
No, just rub them up against the mic every now and then. Anywho.
All right. Well, we're having way too much fun. So I just want to thank everybody for listening. And remember, you can get us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also visit us on our MySpace page at myspace.com/audionowcast. All right. Well, for myself and Rob and Martin, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio.